are checking in right now with First Elect Woman Brenda Kupchick of Fairfield. And Brenda, great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning and Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. I was telling everyone earlier that I'm excited to have a lot of our local leaders coming on more frequently. People love to hear from you guys. So Brenda will be coming on bi-weekly here on the show, and we're very, very excited about that. And we're going to be talking about all things Fairfield whenever Brenda's here, for obvious reasons. First of all, schools reopening at this point. What is the tentative plan for Fairfield? I know just before we got to, I think it was the Thanksgiving break, it kind of became virtual, even though the plan was to make at least elementary school students in person full time. What's the latest in Fairfield?
So they are back. Students are back and teachers are back. That is the plan from the superintendent, and it seems to be going well. I think today may actually, I have to look, or maybe it's tomorrow, might be the first full day, but I have to double check, because to be honest with you, I've been working on putting my budget together, which has been a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. And the superintendent is unveiling his budget tomorrow to the Board of Education.
Okay.
So we've got a lot going on, and I think budgetary issues are going to be huge for all of us, leaders and school boards, due to the pandemic and the changes that had resulted in the hybrid, which was extremely costly to mm-hmm. most towns, to all towns.
Yeah.
So these are things that we're all going to be grappling with this budget cycle, how we're going to fill these holes from last budget and now these changes that do cost money.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to. But one exciting thing I think we should talk about is the vaccine rollout in Fairfield that I'm really proud of. Our director of health, Sam Cleary, has been practicing for quite a while to prepare for this. And I have to say he has done an amazing job. Other towns have been actually coming down to see our clinic and to emulate it.
Oh, cool.
So we have been, yes, it's our health director really deserves a huge shout out. He has been extraordinarily amazing. And one thing he said to me, which I think is interesting, when all of this was started to come out, and I said to him, how are you doing? How are you holding up? And he said, as a public health official, you train your whole life for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, this is like our Super Bowl. And I thought, wow, that's interesting, because, public health officials train to take care of the public in crisis like this.
Right,
Most of us feel it's such a heavy burden. But they look at it like something, that they trained for, and they're trying to implement. So it's pretty cool. And he said, we've been fighting this pandemic since March, and now we actually have something to actually fight with.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So it's exciting. And I just hope we can get more vaccines, because our health department's doing a great job. But obviously, I know a lot of residents have been asking, when can I get vaccinated?
Yeah.
And
that continues
so the state. And that's something I think is really important, Melissa, because I'm getting a ton of emails from residents in response to my newsletter, which clearly has in the link about what the state guidelines are and about the phases, A1 and then the second phase and then the third phase and who gets what. And so people are still very unclear. The general public seems to be very unclear about when they can get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be really helpful to be able to share more of that so that the average citizen understands that we're all following the guidelines from the state.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Talking to First Elect Woman Brenda Kupchick of Fairfield, and we're talking about everything having to do with Fairfield. And Brenda, you did kind of touch on the fact that there are going to be really big budget discussions for very understandable reasons. We're going to see this in every town and city, I'm sure, especially to make up some of the money that needed to be used for our schools in order to keep kids in school. What about taxes? There's been a lot of rumblings that taxes are going up in the town of Fairfield. Is that true? And if so, how much can people kind of anticipate seeing in the town of Fairfield?
So I think what you're probably hearing in Fairfield is, like most towns, we're required by the state to do a valuation, a revaluation of all the properties every 5 years, which
mm-hmm.
is mandatory
okay.
by the state of Connecticut. And so, obviously when this all came, that you have to do it, and We went through the RFP process, and then the Board of Selectmen voted on the company that did it. All towns are doing this. Obviously, as a leader, you're like, wow, this is just a really bad time to have to do a reevaluation of your community.
Sure.
Now, I worked so hard last year. When I passed my budget back in March, it had a 2.46 increase, and then the pandemic hit a week later. And so we were all scrambling to try our best, you know, the other boards and myself, to deliver 0%, which was the first one ever in Fairfield's history, because we felt like so many people lost their jobs, so many people were having a tough time, and yeah. we wanted to be able to provide some relief. So the 0% was great, but we had to do some budgetary things to get to that. Mm-hmm. So this year we're going to have to, you know, backfill some areas where we took. And you're right, it costs so much to outfit schools so that students and teachers could go back in a safe manner. And that costs money. Mm-hmm. I mean, it costs a lot of money. And even the online academy. So, for example, any child that didn't or any parent who didn't want their children in the school were afforded the opportunity to have 100% virtual,
right.
which required teachers, extra staff, extra work, extra money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of money that the pandemic has cost all towns. So yeah, we're going to have a real struggle here. And the revaluation, I think that's what you were saying. Yeah, some people's properties went up significantly. And so I've been holding reval meetings virtually. I'm going to do another one this week. And I did one with the beach area residents last week, just so that the revaluation company and the tax assessor could explain the process, because it is complicated and people don't necessarily understand it. I don't completely understand it. I'm not an assessor. But they're concerned that the COVID jump in prices on housing had an impact on some real estate values.
Okay. But that's part of the assessing process. That's what they're looking at.
Yes. And
okay.
I think that might be what you're hearing right from residents, is that, my taxes are going to go up because I got that card in the mail from the revaluation company that my value went up.
Okay.
Which most people, if your value goes up, you think. But I think there's just based on what I'm, we're having so many meetings about this now, but the grand list went up about 7.5%. In town, in the commercial went up 2%, which is actually very encouraging.
Okay.
However, it looks like we may be able to lower the mill rate. So this is still very early on in the process. People have the ability to appeal, and people will be signing up to appeal to the Board of Assessment Appeals. And I'm quite sure they're going to be taking into consideration the jump in costs due to the pandemic, because so many New Yorkers were coming into Fairfield County.
Right.
And buying houses.
Right.
So there's a lot. And I think people, I get it. People are concerned about taxes. I'm going to do everything in my power to keep them as level as possible.
Okay. All right. Well, First Electwoman Brenda Kupchick, we appreciate your honesty with all of this. And thank you so much. We'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
All right, Melissa, you take care. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too, Brenda. Good morning, Officer DeVito. How are you?
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thank you so much. So one of our top around the region news stories was following the riots last week at the U.S. Capitol. A Capitol police officer took his own life. This was a 51-year-old man who died Saturday, and he was a 15-year veteran. And it sort of prompts the question this morning about what Connecticut does or doesn't do enough to support our police officers. You guys, unfortunately, go through trauma. Whether, how tough or how not tough you guys are, guys and gals, I should say, you guys see and experience things that most people can't even think up in their minds. So what does Connecticut First Off do to support police officers and firefighters, first responders, when it comes to trauma and dealing with the aftermath?
Right. So because of the nature of the events and the confidentiality of it, it would be something that wouldn't be, shared as much as you can imagine. So it's really up to individual departments to, to monitor and to take care of their own. And then we do have plans. Obviously, we have, internal plans in place, kind of like watch guards. So our officers, our command staff can monitor events that we know of. So you have to understand, there's a lot of it. Obviously, there's high trauma events that occur on duty, so we can watch our officers and our men and women that are involved and monitor and track them and offer them services. But there's also a lot of in every line of work, and ours is no different. There's a lot of personal issues that go on in officers' lives that will affect them while they're at work that we don't really know of. Those are the ones that are tricky ones we have to watch for, so that you know activities going on in their personal life, whether financial strife, health issues with them, their close ones, and those such as that, and then that will end up, transferring and affecting them at work. And we still have our command staff that has to monitor and keep an eye on some touch points with if their officers are acting peculiar or whatnot. Mm. And then we offer obviously like EAP programs. We have those in place. We can pull officers in and send them there, and obviously they're confidential. Not like any other vocation, people are in general very reluctant to share or disclose, personal inadequacies in their life.
Totally.
That affect them across the board, whether it affects their job performance, their parental performance. They don't like to share that, and they're reluctant. It's, takes a keen eye to notice that. So what we really do is we look for, and we do have this. We have issues here all the time, and we just really look for some obvious, change in behavior and performance, and not in a disciplinary way, but in a way we can maybe just get out ahead of this. And we have, steps in place that we do. And again, we do it confidentially. We do it in accordance with our contracts, not to disclose, maybe not to penalize anybody. But obviously with the end result is we don't want officers out working if there's any kind of any issues that, will affect their performance, and because we know what happens when you sprinkle in stressful incidents to that to an officer who's, so that's what we try to avoid.
Now, what about instances where that people are not going to go home feeling the same as they did when they showed up to a scene? For example, like a Sandy Hook. I can't imagine one first responder who went to that scene and then went home and just went on with their daily lives. Like, are you required, or do departments put into place, hey, you know what, we just went through this as a department, we're all going to either get mental health evaluations or do like check-ins, or we're going to have somebody come through and ask questions? Like, is there anything like that in place when there's going to be trauma probably following an event as awful as Sandy Hook, for example?
Yeah, so in reference to that case directly, that's I think we just passed the 8-year anniversary, correct?
Yes, so correct.
8 years ago, they reached out. They're what you'd call in Connecticut size a smaller department. They're close to about 60 officers, so they were obviously affected, almost across the board. And what they did for a couple of weeks, we went there to Newtown, and it was Milford, Stratford, Trumbull, the state police, and I may be missing one or two, but we went there on a daily basis around the clock and filled in and just answered their regular calls. So because they were so affected by it, and they're, like I said, not a huge department, and so many officers who were involved in the investigation, so many officers that were involved in the aftermath and were maybe unable to come back to work right away. So we filled in and we helped out. That's in an extreme circumstance. We will do that on a smaller basis. Maybe if a department suffers maybe like in a case of a death of one of their officers, their funeral will work for 24 hours or maybe 32 hours. We'll answer all their calls while they can attend to that stuff. So those are things that happen in a very awful circumstance where the department is affected almost across the board. But in a smaller, instance where officers go to a really traumatic scene, we bring our command staff in immediately, and we'll have our officers, meet with them and, privately, and some officers will, take a day or two off, some maybe won't. And again, it comes back to that reluctancy. And there are some issues with, not showing a sign of weakness, whether it's for, maybe they just need to, financially, they need to work and they need to be there for that reason. Or maybe they need to be there for the mental health side of it. They need to be around their coworkers. They'd rather be at work than home or alone or going somewhere else.
Officer Mike DeVito of the Milford Police Department, thank you so much for giving us some of this insight, and we'll talk again next week.
Okay, great. Thank you. Have a nice week.
Thank you. You too. Senator Huang, thank you for being here this morning. How are you?
What morning. It seems another week has passed.
Yes, that's very true. Very true. And I know it's a big week at the Capitol here in Connecticut, as we're going to kind of dive into more pandemic and budget necessary items, which is very good. But I did want to talk about a couple of things outside of that. First of all, we saw some disturbing data that came out of Bridgeport this weekend. The highest homicide numbers in comparison to 2019 that we've seen in years. What are lawmakers talking about when it comes to gun violence, especially among younger people? That seems to be a big problem in a lot of our cities like Bridgeport and Hartford.
Well, it really is an alarming and disconcerting data trend where homicides are up, non-fatal shootings are up, and our police are under such tremendous pressure, in essence, causing people to leave the profession early, creating a shortage of staff, as evident by Bridgeport, that was recently announced by the acting police chief. And what all of that does is create an environment that says lawlessness and the ability to engage in gun violence, crime, because it just isn't able to keep up from law enforcement. And sometimes, because of the uniqueness of the climate that we're in, police officers are looking over their shoulder. And I am still impacted by some of the emotionality and the raw honesty of Sergeant Perez in regards to how law enforcement truly feels. Mm-hmm. Because you don't really get a lot of that, because they have a job to do. It's an organized structure. People just get to work. But in our law enforcement, and we just had law enforcement appreciation a couple days ago, the struggle has changed. The dynamic has changed. And you're seeing that, unfortunately, we are inching toward, in my mind, an environment of somewhat permissiveness and somewhat limiting what law enforcement has to do to be able to maintain law and order. So it really is a disconcerting, and really, I think for us to resolve it, we have to reevaluate the dynamics and the relationships to be able to renew the reinforcement and support of our law enforcement for the job that they do, but openly criticize and transparently make sure that they are reflecting the needs of the community. So it's a delicate balancing act, but unfortunately, I think the police accountability bill that has been passed needs to be addressed. And unfortunately, in my 10 days up in Hartford, there appears to be no appetite to addressing this issue. Mm-hmm. And I hope that changes, because mm-hmm. I think we have to make that bill more responsive, because ultimately, real facts and data in regards to crime and public safety has to be considered.
I mean, do you fear that the pandemic is going to get in the way of many things, like talking about the police accountability bill? Because I there were really hot button topics that came up, not just over the summer, but right before the pandemic happened. And it seems like, other than, to be honest, stuff that could grow our economy, like pot or sports betting, bringing money into Connecticut, it seems like some of those hot button topics are just being sidelined until question mark.
Well, I think that is one of the challenges we have in a one-party rule in which Democrats run the Senate, the House, and the executive branch, that they dictate the agenda. And unfortunately, this may not be a palatable issue to approach, because ultimately it was a bad bill that got passed without full articulation and vetting. And you don't want to revisit something that you've done badly. Mm-hmm. But my hope is that we consider that the impact and the consequences of public policy has to be reevaluated, whether we did a good job or not. Look, we're not perfect up to the legislature, and if we make mistakes, we need to go back and fix it. We do it all the time, but when it's policy like this, in which people on a one-sided policy made that decision, the consequences may be important to consider and do that, but I don't see it right now. I hope it changes, But I think, again, I go back to being on the radio, raising the issue for people to ask the question. That's important, where the public has a say on this.
Mm-hmm. Talking to State Senator Tony Huang, and I know later this week you're going to be doing a virtual event to bring attention to what happened last week at our nation's capital. And how do we go forward as a nation or even just as a state? What are some of the lessons that you think we could draw, Senator, from last week and be able to apply to better Connecticut?
It has just only been a week, has it not? And it seems
not even right
with COVID and all the dynamics and the fast pace of which we get our news to literally get photos, compelling and sometimes shocking photos and data all immediately in front of us. It seems like we're living history, and I truly believe this is something where, you know, in future generations, your kids will talk about when the U.S. Capitol was taken over, because mm-hmm. that's the last time it was taken over was in the War of 1812.
Right.
And so what we want to do in this lesson with a virtual conversation that's going to be held at Sacred Heart University to kind of get beyond the shock, to really discuss how lessons could be learned, to understand the dynamics that led to those things. That's important to understand. With Black Lives Matters, with all the emotional angst and the protests and the frustration that sometimes spill over into the challenges that we see that appeared on our screens last week, mm-hmm. is we need to understand what causes that, to fully understand that and to be able to take lessons learned. And that's what we're looking to do with Dr. Gary Rose, a renowned political scientist, and former police Fairfield police chief Gary Rowe, Gary McNamara, mm-hmm. and for me, from a policy standpoint, to just kind of break it down, to have a conversation to say, this is something that's unprecedented. But what causes this? What history led to this? It just didn't happen overnight.
Right.
But for us to try to take lessons from this and learn to avoid any future incidences on this. Because ultimately, there are three things that happened in that case. One, it is an assault on our democracy. It is a threat to public health and safety, public safety. And number three, it also foments why people feel that way, mm-hmm. to undertake that kind of level of violence, mm-hmm. and violation of our democracy. Somehow, public policy and the way in which we are interacting in the political process, in a representative process, is not working.
Mm-hmm. It's a great conversation. And again, this is a free virtual event. So if you want in on it, it's happening Wednesday, January 13th at 2:00 in the afternoon. All you do is go to www.sacredheart.edu/insurrection. And State Senator Tony Huang, thank you so much for coming on this morning. We'll talk again next week.
Have a great week, and let's hope this week is a little calmer.
Yes, I think that's a great hope for all of us. Thank you so much.